All right, welcome everyone to another deep dive here on LexPlug. Every time we do one of these, I always think we're going to run out of cases that are, just super fascinating, but then we find one like this, People v. Nazeri from 2010 in California. And I'm reminded just how many truly interesting cases are out there. This one really digs into something that I find just really fascinating, which is the difference between like an impulsive crime versus a really calculated one. And I'm really glad to have our expert here today who can kind of walk us through all of that.
Yeah, I think this one is a really good deep dive, especially for law students or anyone really who's interested in this kind of thing, because it goes right to the heart of intent. Like, what was going on in this guy's mind when he did what he did, and the fact that his first degree murder convictions were upheld, it says a lot about what the courts consider to be real premeditation, and it's something that anyone going into law should probably get a good grasp on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the first thing to do is to just lay out the facts of the case, right? So we're talking about August of 2006, and we have our defendant, Bahram Nazlı, who is at home with his brothers. And we don't know a ton about the context here, but it sounds like things were already pretty tense. He was really emotionally distressed, even with his brothers there. And there's some mention that maybe he was even thinking about suicide. Then his wife, Nushin, and mother-in-law, Parveen, come to the house. And well, things escalate really quickly from there.
Yeah, when they say escalate, we're talking brutal. I mean, he stabs both women to death, right? And it wasn't just a single wound or anything like that. I mean, multiple stab wounds on both Nushin and Parveen. And then after all of that, after killing them, he tries to kill himself too. So it's a pretty it's a rough scene to picture. And it really raises that question right away. Like, what was his mental state? I mean, was this just a momentary I don't know, explosion? Or was there something more deliberate at play?
And one of the things that the court really focused on, and this is something for everyone listening to really pay attention to because it's so important, is the murder weapon itself. So it wasn't a kitchen knife, like something you might just grab in the heat of the moment, during an argument in the kitchen. No, this was an ornamental knife, and the court records say that it was usually kept upstairs. So the fact that Nazeri went and got that specific knife before he did anything, that's a big deal when it comes to talking about premeditation.
Oh, absolutely. Huge. I mean, the fact that he specifically went to retrieve that knife, it suggests that this wasn't just a spontaneous, reaction. It implies a level of conscious decision making, right? Like, he was actively preparing. And when you add that to the fact that he apparently had all these suspicions about Nushin, his wife, maybe she was cheating on him. Maybe there was some kind of plot to, I don't know, get his insurance money or something. And then there's the mother-in-law, Parveen. There are reports that she had been mocking him, which obviously would add fuel to the fire.
So you've got this whole backdrop of resentment, potential infidelity, and then this very deliberate act of going to get this specific weapon. And then at trial, Nazeri claims self-defense. Right. He says that Nushin actually attacked him first, but as we know, the jury didn't buy it. So with all that in mind, let's talk about the real core legal issue here, the question that the court had to figure out.
Right. And that was whether the prosecution had actually proven premeditation and deliberation. And when we're talking about first degree murder, those two elements are crucial, right? You have to have them. It's not enough to just show that someone wanted to kill. The prosecution needs to show that the defendant actually thought it out, that it was planned, and that there was a certain amount of, cool, calculated judgment involved. That's the real bar for a first degree conviction.
Okay, so let's break that down even further. What are the actual pieces of a first degree murder charge in California? What does the prosecution need to show to get that conviction?
Okay, so in California, for first degree murder, the prosecution has to prove a few things. First, there's malice aforethought. And essentially, that means that they intended to kill. Legally, it's not always that simple. It can get pretty nuanced because historically, it's included things like just extreme recklessness. But when we're talking about first degree murder, it usually comes down to proving that there was a specific intent to kill. Then they have to prove that the act was willful, meaning it wasn't an accident. And finally, here come the really important parts for first degree: premeditation, which means it was planned beforehand, and deliberation, meaning there was a more reasoned, kind of cold assessment of the decision to kill.
Gotcha. So this is where those famous Anderson factors come in, right? I always hear those mentioned when we're talking about these types of cases. Can you explain what they are and how the courts use them?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the Anderson factors come from a case called People v. Anderson. And in that case, the California Supreme Court laid out this framework that courts use all the time to analyze whether there's enough evidence to prove premeditation and deliberation. There are three factors. First, was there any planning activity before the murder? Second, was there a motive? Like, did the defendant have a reason to want to kill the victim? And third, what was the manner of the killing? Does it look like there was some kind of, you know, preconceived plan to cause death? But, and this is really important for you to understand, these are just factors. They're not like a checklist where if you have all three, then boom, it's automatically first-degree murder. It's more about using them as a guide, a framework. Having one or two of these factors can help the jury decide whether there was premeditation and deliberation.
So we've talked about what makes first-degree murder different from other kinds of murder, but how about second-degree specifically? What's the real dividing line there?
It all boils down to that premeditation and deliberation, right? In second-degree murder, you might have an intent to kill, or maybe a really reckless disregard for human life, but the key is that it wasn't planned out.
Yeah.
There's no cold, calculated decision-making beforehand.
Mm.
It's more about that lack of prior thought and a lack of weighing the consequences.
Yeah.
That's a big part of what separates it from first degree.
Right. Okay. So with that in mind, let's go back to People v. Nazeri and see how the court applied these Anderson factors to the specific facts of the case, starting with that first factor, planning. What did the court think about the fact that he went upstairs to get that ornamental knife?
Right. So the court really latched onto that fact because, you know, it wasn't a knife that was just readily available. It really suggested that he had made a decision to arm himself before anything went down. The court called this a premeditated act, specifically because it wasn't a reaction to what was happening in that moment, but a deliberate step he took before the attack. It showed that he was choosing to get that weapon for a reason.
And it makes sense when you think about it in legal terms, right? It goes beyond just being angry and lashing out. He was specifically choosing a weapon, which suggests some level of thought beforehand. Okay, so what about the second Anderson factor, motive? What did they identify as his potential reasons for doing this?
They focused on what they called a pre-existing motive, which basically means that there were reasons why he might have wanted to kill them that existed before that specific night.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was suspicious of Nushin. Maybe she was cheating on him. He thought maybe there was a plot against him involving his life insurance. And then there was all that resentment toward Parvain, his mother-in-law. So it wasn't just a random act of violence. There was a history there, you know, a history of bad blood.
So there was already a reason to want them dead, not just something that happened in the heat of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and last but not least, let's talk about the third Anderson factor, the manner of the killing. How did the way he attacked them factor into the court's thinking?
The manner of the killing was huge in this case. So we're talking multiple stab wounds on both victims. And the wounds weren't random. They were in vital areas. You know, their necks, internal organs. Parvain even had a stab wound to her eye. So the court saw this as a calculated attack, not a spontaneous, out-of-control one. The sheer number of wounds and the fact that he went for those specific areas, it really pointed towards a deliberate intention to kill.
And one thing I remember reading about the case was that the court specifically mentioned the fact that he continued to attack even after the victims were incapacitated. Why was that so legally important?
Yeah, that's a really important point. So even if you were to say, okay, maybe the first couple stabs were in the heat of the moment, the fact that he kept attacking after they were most likely unable to fight back, that showed a different level of intent. It shows that it wasn't just a momentary burst of anger. He continued to attack even when it wasn't necessary for self-defense or anything like that. It showed that there was this persistent decision to kill, not just to injure.
It's a pretty disturbing thing to think about, but from a legal standpoint, it makes sense why that would matter so much. It really drives home the point that the intention to kill wasn't fleeting. It was something he actively continued to act on. Now, what about Nazer's attempts to claim self-defense in heat of passion? Why didn't those arguments work?
Well, for the self-defense claim, it's likely that the evidence just didn't add up. You know, the fact that there were so many wounds that he'd gone to get the knife beforehand, those things don't really fit with the idea that he was just defending himself against Nushin. And as for the heat of passion argument, that defense usually needs to show that there was some kind of sudden provocation, something that would make any reasonable person lose control and react without thinking. But in Nazari's case, there was all that pre-existing resentment toward the victims, plus the fact that he got the knife beforehand. So it was hard to argue that he was just reacting to something that happened in that moment. Plus, his suicide attempt afterwards, the court saw that more as a sign of regret, you know, like he was remorseful for what he'd done, rather than as proof that he wasn't thinking clearly when it happened.
It makes a lot of sense. So are there any key quotes from the judge's opinion, Justice Sills, that really stick out to you in this case?
Yeah, there are a couple of quotes that I think are really worth highlighting. One is where Justice Sills says the ornamental knife was normally kept upstairs. And as we've talked about, that seemingly small detail was really important because it allowed the jury to infer planning. It meant he had to make a decision to get that weapon.
It's like he wasn't just grabbing whatever was nearby. He was selecting a weapon specifically. What's another one that stands out to you?
I think this one really gets to the heart of the case. He says, numerous blows to vital organs, intended to kill, not wound. And that really underscores just how deliberate and calculated this attack was. By saying that he was going for those vital areas and that he did it multiple times, it really pushes the idea that Nasri's goal was to cause death, not just to lash out in anger.
So he wasn't trying to injure them. He was trying to kill them. And earlier we were talking about how the Anderson factors aren't a checklist, that the court has some flexibility there. Did Justice Sills talk about that in his opinion?
Oh, yeah, he did. And it's super important to understand that point. He specifically said, the Anderson factors are guidelines, not a checklist. And what that means is that the court doesn't have to see all three factors to decide whether there was premeditation. Sometimes, really strong evidence of one factor, like maybe a super clear motive, can outweigh weaker evidence of another factor. It's about looking at the whole picture, you know, the totality of the circumstances.
So it's not just about checking boxes, it's about understanding the full context. Now, what did the court say about how much time is actually needed to prove premeditation? I mean, it's not like someone has to spend weeks planning something out, right?
Exactly. And this is a point that comes up a lot. And the court in People v. Nadziri really emphasized it. They said that you don't need to have a long planning period to prove premeditation. Even just a few moments of reflection where the defendant decides to kill and weighs their options, that can be enough. And this case is a good example of that. Even though everything happened pretty quickly, the jury in the court still found that there was enough evidence to show that he thought about it before he acted.
So even a short period of thinking about it can be enough. So for those of you listening who are in law school or maybe thinking about going to law school, what are the big takeaways from this case about first-degree murder? What are the core principles that it illustrates?
I think there are a couple of big things for law students to take away from this. First, it really shows that to get a conviction for first-degree murder, you need more than just a brutal killing. You have to show that there was some level of thinking and planning involved. Even if it was just for a short time, the prosecution has to prove that the defendant thought about killing before they did it. Second, People v. Nasseri really highlights how important circumstantial evidence is in these cases. A lot of times, there isn't going to be direct evidence of what someone was thinking, so you have to rely on the circumstances surrounding the crime. Things like, what weapon was used? Was there a motive? How was the killing carried out? Those are all clues that can help a jury decide what the defendant's intent was.
What about the defense strategies in this case? I mean, Nasri's lawyers tried to argue self-defense and heat of passion, but those didn't work. What can law students learn from that?
Yeah, I think the fact that those defenses failed is really instructive. It shows just how important it is to understand the specifics of each legal defense. For example, with heat of passion, you usually have to show that there was some kind of extreme and sudden provocation that would cause a reasonable person to lose control. But in this case, there was all that evidence of prior bad feelings, plus the fact that he went to get the knife. So it was really difficult to argue that he was just reacting in the heat of the moment. And the takeaway there is that if there's evidence of bad blood beforehand and actions that suggest planning, it's going to be much harder to make a heat of passion argument stick.
It's like the more evidence there is of planning and premeditation, the harder it is to argue that it was just a spontaneous, unplanned act. So it sounds like People v. Nasseri is a really good case study for understanding how the Anderson factors actually work in practice, how they're used to figure out if there was premeditation. It's not just a simple formula. It's about looking at all the different pieces of the puzzle and seeing how they fit together.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the key thing to remember is that the decision in this case, and in most cases like this, is based on the totality of the circumstances. It's not about any one piece of evidence in isolation. It's about looking at everything. The fact that Nasri got the knife from upstairs, the motive, the way the killings were carried out, all of that together was what ultimately convinced the court that there was enough evidence to prove first-degree murder.
So it's about understanding the whole story, not just focusing on one or two details. Well, that about wraps up our deep dive into the People v. Nadziri case. Thanks for joining us today as we explored this really interesting case and what it teaches us about premeditation in the law.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a case that really makes you think, and I think there's a lot to learn from it.
And for everyone listening at home, as you're thinking about everything we've talked about today, here's something to consider. Remember those three Anderson factors we discussed: planning, motive, and manner of killing. What other kinds of circumstantial evidence, beyond what we saw in this case, could a prosecutor use to strengthen their argument for premeditation in a murder trial? Think about the bigger picture, you know, what a defendant might do or say before or after the crime that could shed light on their intentions. It's a fascinating question to ponder, and it shows just how complex these legal issues can be.